So this is 27 August 76 at Grenoble, and talking with Peter Scheuer. So before we talk about your first scientific publication and so forth, could you tell me a little bit about your background before you came to Cambridge, and then how you got involved with the Radio Astronomy Group?
Well, born Frankfurt am Main, 1930. My father was Jewish, so we left to Germany after the usual difficulties. Fortunately got out just before the war started. And then I went to school and all that. And I was an undergraduate in St. John's College, Cambridge. And towards the end of my third year, I heard Martin Ryle talk, giving one of the talks that various research groups give to undergraduates. That seemed to be a subject where one could still make progress with fairly straightforward experimental methods. One could understand what the problems were because they were very open.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I had no taste whatever for electronics, I thought this would be an interesting thing to go into.
And what year was this now when you...
And the first thing that I worked on, sorry?
What year was this?
This was 51.
Okay.
So, the first thing I worked on was trying to get some notion of the width of the radio emission from the galactic plane for two reasons. One is that there had been a suggestion in the literature that the galactic plane got wider and wider at lower frequencies, and the suspicion was that this was simply because the beams got wider. And the other was that a paper by Westerhout and Oort had appeared in which they discussed the contribution of the H2 regions to possible radio emission from the galaxy, and one should be able to separate this out because the H2 regions were very closely concentrated to the galactic plane.
Right.
So we set up an interferometer at curious angles.
And when you say I assume that
this was Martin Ryle.
Ryle basically had the idea to do this.
Ryle had the idea to do this,
and you were his research student.
I was his research student.
Right.
Yes.
And so, now can you just describe the experiment and the results?
Oh well, the experiment was obviously the methods were very primitive in those days. And so we put up a couple of aerials and we put them up at an odd angle across the field next to the behind the university football ground, where radio astronomy was conducted in those days.
That's the Grange Road.
That's the Grange Road site.
Yeah.
And along a line such that we'd catch the galactic plane at the time when the Milky Way formed a vertical great circle.
Right, right.
And we just recorded fringes and then moved the aerials along a bit.
Well, why would...
So did a amplitude spacing.
Ryle was, pretty much convinced to interest in radio sources this time, yet this was a bit of a reversion to extended radiation. Or was it the idea that you were trying to understand the relationship between the radio stars and the possibility that the background might just be the integral? Was that Ryle's real interest, do you think?
No, I think it was trying to separate out the component due to H2 regions. And of course it didn't do that. We did this experiment at several frequencies and it showed that the temperature required of the H2 regions would be well above the conventional 10,000 degrees. It would be something more like 25,000.
Right.
And in the end, it turned out, of course, that there was a population of radio sources which was also very strongly concentrated towards the galactic plane, and that what we were observing was a mixture of the H2 regions and these radio sources.
Which we were...
Supernova remnants.
Oh, supernova remnants,
yes.
Right. Did you recognize these as discrete things?
No. I mean, our interferometer had no resolution along the galactic plane to speak of. It was about 10 degrees resolution along the galactic plane. varying from one frequency to another somewhat.
So you, about this time, of course, Mills came out with his Class 1 and Class 2 source. I'm trying to understand the relationship. You did not really then come up with a second kind of source in the plane. You were more worried just about what the integrated emission was.
We were more worried about what the integrated emission was. Obviously, we were aware of Cassiopeia. The Mills result, I think, didn't reach us till a little later. It was Henry Brown who came up with the notion that all the radiation was from supernova remnants.
I see.
Or at least from a particular class of source, not necessarily supernova remnants. And of course, that wasn't right either. There was an H2 component in what we observed at these low frequencies. In the absorption that one saw at low frequencies.
Now, did you see any
and
absorption?
And it was a mixture of the both. Well,
it talks about a bright band, a 2 degree wide.
Okay.
Bright band.
That's right. Well, there was a very primitive experiment indeed using Grombics that went down to 38 megahertz, and that probably began to see a little absorption. At least the brightness was. Didn't follow the standard mm-hmm. spectrum.
And was it clear to you from the theory of free-free that
at some point
you were going to see absorption?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's probably enough on that, isn't it?
Right. That's sort of a aberration from most of the rest of your work. What was the next thing that you got involved with?
Well, that was my thesis work essentially. That and a little bit of work on free-free, which I didn't publish till.
You had an article in 1960
right.
on the absorption
right.
coefficient.
That's right. But the thing which was the big new instrument was the antenna of four parabolic cylinders that made the 2C survey and later the 3C survey, and still later, in fact, a 408 megahertz survey. Which in retrospect would probably have been the right thing to start off with.
Now hold on, you said 408?
408 megahertz, yes. There is in fact a paper in the literature by Long, Hazler, and Ellsmore in some order.
Yeah.
But anyway, that doesn't matter. I mean, by the time we got around to that, it was unimportant.
Well, what I'm trying to—it's my understanding that the 2C aerial was built with the intention of doing two frequencies, 81 and 170.
And 170, that's right.
And I'm a little confused now what you're saying about relative.
Oh, what I'm saying is that if we had understood the confusion problem well enough,
right,
it would have been fairly clear that the right frequency to start off on would have been a much higher frequency than 80 megahertz, because. With the wisdom of hindsight, one knows that one wants 50 beams per source rather than one beam per source, which is one's first intuitive order of magnitude estimate.
Right, right.
And which, of course, led to all the trouble with the 2C survey.
But even 170 would have maybe
170 was better, but 170 was better, but it was still confusion limited.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it has to be one or the other, confusion or sensitivity limited.
Yes.
But I mean, this is an interesting question to me. Apparently, there was discussion about which frequency to do first.
But given,
And the low frequency went out, Ryle said one problem is some interference at the higher frequencies and such. And I'm just interested, if indeed the high frequency survey had done it first, do you think the confusion problems would have still been there at 170?
At 170, there would still have been confusion problems. And what the interpretation would have been, I don't know.
Yeah.
But we'll get on to that, I'm sure. That's a long story.
Anyway, this is all trying to rewrite history, mm-hmm. which is not. I want to just look at what did happen. So you were involved with the 2C survey.
No, I was not involved with the 2C survey.
Oh no, you're not. You're not a co-author of it, actually.
Nope.
I see. But you were very involved with the analysis of the results.
I was not involved with the results of the 2C survey. No, the thing that I was involved in is what has come to be known as P of D.
Right.
Now the. This has very curious history in that as the 2C survey was progressing, one of the worries was that Martin was aware of the confusion problem, although obviously it wasn't very clear what it consisted of. That the way he expressed it to me, so far as I can remember, in the first instance, was that if you have a bright source, it will conceal a fainter source that is near it. And therefore we shall miss a lot of faint sources. Of course, on going into the problem, one realizes in the end that it's the other way up.
Yeah.
And that one gets that the predominant effect is two weak sources building up to, or several weak sources building up into something that appears rather stronger.
So the initial impetus you're saying was a bit mistaken, but nevertheless,
I then went to being sort of one of the more mathematically inclined of the students there, which isn't saying much. There weren't many of us. I thought, well, one ought to be able to work out what the probability distribution of the amplitudes on the record is. This is a well-defined problem in probability theory. And I felt very pleased with myself when I got an answer after several months of doing what a well-educated student now could do in an afternoon, rediscovering on the way various well-known items in probability theory.
Right.
And the trouble with this was, I think, threefold. We then went ahead and published an article in which the counts from the two C sources were published, and also some results of the analysis of the records using the probability of the deflection on the record.
This is Royal and Schuyler 55.
That's right. That's right. And the PFD method did not give the same answer. It did not indicate as large a deviation from the slope of 1.5 as the counts did.
Right.
And so it was thoroughly unpopular at home for that reason, if one pressed it to this quantitative conclusion. And nobody else believed it because, of course, it was well known. For one thing, there was the great argument with Mills's group.
Right.
And this was just... the typical of the comments on this would be one that was made at the Paris Symposium, that it's obvious that you can't get anything out of the observations by this piece of this alleged piece of black magic. You can't extract anything out of the observations by mathematics that isn't there in the first place, and as the observations were no good in the first place, this must be all wrong.
Would you say?
And nobody understood it, largely because nobody bothered to understand it.
Yeah, they basically just said, "Well, it was rejected. The survey's bad, and so why should we worry about an analysis? It's sort of a rearguard action to scrap something out of it." I mean,
that's right.
What people were thinking.
Well, if you read the proceedings of the Paris Symposium, I think you'll see the remark I'm referring to.
But nevertheless,
that was 1958.
The slope that you got was not 1.5.
No, it was, the nearest guess I could make was around about 2. I can't remember what the figure quoted was. But it was round about 2 if one had to make a guess at some mythical slope. Of course, it doesn't work that way.
Right. Well, I've just been talking with Mills, actually, in the last days. And one point he made that he didn't like, I'd be interested in your response, is that you had to assume an even distribution of sources in this. That everything was sort of based
was
on
random.
That,
yes. The sources were uncorrelated.
Whereas
with each other.
In his
that
first
of course was another that of course was another bone of contention in that he found a lot of extended sources.
Right. Well, but that was one part of it. But also he found in his initial part of his MSH survey that there was some clustering effects. Now they went away later on, but he was arguing at that time that such effects would invalidate the PFD analysis.
Yes, that is quite true. That's quite true. There's another thing that would invalidate the PFD or the counts, which is that one didn't know at that time what the angular diameter distribution was, and of course anything done with an interferometer would discriminate against large diameter sources.
Right.
And given the same kind of source, of course, the closer ones would have larger angular diameters. And this was the thing which worried me most about the source counts later on, when we understood the confusion problem properly, and of course I believed the PFD analysis. So that I believed that there probably was something wrong, even though the statistical significance wasn't enormous.
Were you willing to look at Mills' survey to find out what percentage of sources were extended?
Well, we weren't in a position to do that.
In the beginning, anyway.
Because his were in the southern hemisphere, very largely. His first strip was fairly far south. But we didn't have... We couldn't look at angular diameters very much. I mean, most of the angular diameters were too small to resolve.
Yes, but what I'm thinking is that you could take his survey, just as a statistical sort of thing, and find out what percentage of sources are in what fraction of them are a certain angular size and so forth, at least to his resolution. And this might give you some input into the angular diameter distribution.
Well, how would we do that? I suppose we could take the total power survey and compare that with the interferometer survey and see whether very much more turned up.
This sort of thing, yeah.
This sort
of
thing.
And if they tended to be the extended ones.
The tendency was, though, for the total power survey to show a good deal less.
Yeah, and of course even
than the interferometer survey.
And even those.
And the reason was partly that in the interferometer survey you could convince yourself. I mean, this was part of the optimism that was in the original analysis of the 2C survey. That on the interferometer record you could convince yourself that every beam-sized set of wiggles represented the source.
Right.
If you felt that way inclined, whereas on the total power survey you couldn't.
Yeah. But the other thing was.
So at that stage we really weren't in a position to do it. The obvious way out of that. And I was quite amused to see that Bernie Mills proposed this again at last week's symposium in Cambridge.
Right.
Was that you did surveys you did surveys with various scaled aerial systems, so that you could cancel out any angular diameter effects or clustering effects or whatever they might be by changing the scale as you go deeper, as you go to lower flux levels. This is a sort of first order way of cancelling out the any angular diameter effects.
I wasn't there when he made that comment. Now, did he make this comment also back in the late 50s, are you saying?
I don't know whether he did or not. I don't remember him doing it in print. I certainly made it privately and among ourselves. But of course this would involve a large-scale construction program, especially for the job. And,
nice in principle.
By the time one might have done this, there were better things invented, like synthesis.
Well, let me ask about the PFD. I'm a little confused as to whether it all along was part of the game plan, so to speak, for 2C that we.
No. It came up after the observations had started to come through.
But before Mills's, was it a response to Mills's?
No. It wasn't a response to Mills's thing.
I see. Okay.
No, I did that analysis. You know, I worked all that out in 1954. I didn't put it into my thesis because it wasn't really related to that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I was caught in the tail end of National Service. I spent the next 2 years away, so that's why it wasn't written up till 1957.
I see. That explains the 3-year gap.
That's right. Which, of course, everybody else knew very well was Cambridge secretiveness.
It was really the Suez Crisis or something like that?
No.
But let me also ask about, how did it happen to get published in the Proceedings of the Cambridge Philosophical Society?
We tried various journals, like Monthly Notice, and they wouldn't have it because it was tarred with the same brush as the source counts.
It was
clearly disreputable.
I see.
So in the end, rather reluctantly, the editors of Procam Philosophical said that, well, they would take this on.
Well, that's a damn good thing it finally did.
Nobody was willing to have it.
Okay, another question about this whole controversy. I'd be interested in your point of view. It seems to me that there was a great confusion, not to be a pun, in issues, that people were arguing back and forth about several different things, and often at cross purposes. One was the validity of PID and whether it was really an independent check. The second thing was the effect of extended sources.
No, one of the things about PFD, to make clear, the sort of comment was that you clearly couldn't extract information at about sources below the one per beam width level. And the thing that was that took years and years and years and years and years to sink in was that I had, in fact, carefully this is the sort of comment made mostly by people, of course, who hadn't read my paper, and I don't complain of this because I don't read the literature very much either. But I had, in fact, spent two pages explaining precisely why you couldn't go beyond the one per beam width level, but that the PFD method could give you information down to the one per beam width level, whereas source counts, as such, could only give you information down to the one per 20 or 50. Beamwidths level.
So they were arguing at a something.
It was, as you said, arguing at cross purposes. Right. I was merely explaining, you know, where the cross purpose arose.
Another thing that was being argued about, of course, and influenced all this was which sort of cosmology you were inclined towards, the steady state or evolving cosmology.
Yes.
Another thing was what should be counted as a source. I think that this was going on. And the net effect was that. These issues didn't get defined, really.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with this? That if there'd been some debate referee or something that could have kept the issues separate, that things might have gone more smoothly? Or
I didn't get the impression that that one was inclined to any particular kind of cosmology. After all, Martin Ryle didn't have particular prejudices about what sort of cosmology he liked.
Well, maybe not before he began the 2C, but once he had the steep slope and he saw that this could say something about cosmology, he certainly had inclinations for the next many years, did he not?
Towards saying that it couldn't be steady state?
Yes.
Yes. But not towards any particular cosmological theory. He's not a theoretician.
Right, but
he's not inclined that way.
I'm just talking about an evolving cosmology versus steady state, just that distinction,
not
what kind of evolving.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And
but I think he'd have been quite happy with steady state if steady state could have explained those source counts.
Yeah. Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah. But, I see what you're saying.
I don't think he had any particular predilection for one cosmology or another.
Okay. I guess that's right. So in the case of Ryle, anyway, you couldn't say that, but in the case of... Okay, so Ryle is sticking by, and the Cambridge group are sticking by their source counts. The theorists, like Hoyle and Bondi, of course, are sticking by their theory.
Yes, it's very natural. I mean, Hoyle built the steady... Well, Hoyle, Bondi, and Gold built the steady state theory, but Hoyle was one of the people who built the steady state theory, and Ryle built his radio telescope.
Right. and Mills also
Mills built his radio telescope.
Okay, I see what you're saying. That makes sense.
It's what people's interests are that matters, isn't it?
Another question is, it seems incredible to me with the amount of talent in the Cambridge group that the confusion problem wasn't realized. I mean, it's always easy in hindsight, but do you have any thoughts as to how this went wrong?
I think it was realized. It was realized in principle. What wasn't realized, probably, was just how bad it was. You know, one knew that there was a dimensionless number.
Yeah.
You know, the number of beam widths you had to have per source. And one's first assumption is this is of order unity. And I think what one didn't realize at first was how big that number was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was that having built what was at that time, you know, the biggest aerial in the world, right. so on and so forth,
right.
the temptation to extract as many sources as possible was very great.
Right.
And I'm sure that played a part. How big a part, I don't know. Mm-hmm. As I said, I wasn't directly involved. Obviously, we were all very closely involved at that stage because yeah. there were so few of us. And everybody knew what everybody else was doing, which is no longer the case. But different people were inclined different ways on this.
As to how many sources should be extracted, are you saying?
As to how big the confusion problem was. But all I can say now would be speculation and would probably be tainted with all sorts of considerations since, so I think it would be better if I didn't put it on your tape.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, with that proviso, though, it still might be useful if it's your honest opinion as to what was going on then. I mean, that's true of everything that one says, you know, it's after 20 years. And,
yes.
So don't let that stop you if you want to say some. I'd be interested in hearing some more about.
Yes. I think it would be so speculative that I'd rather not put it on your tape.
If it's speculative, right.
You know, one can never rely on one's memory. One's memory plays strange tricks.
Right. Now, the 3C survey, as I've already mentioned, was not something in reply to Mills' survey. It was part of the plan all along, right?
That was part of the plan all along, yes.
And
it really was a question of which frequency one did first.
But I guess it gained an urgency to it because of all this ruckus, and you wanted to get things straightened out, and the Cambridge group, I mean.
I doubt whether it would have made much difference, because after all, once you've done a survey of the sky, and that aerial is then obsolete until you change it to a different frequency.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that just went ahead as...
Mm-hmm.
I'd be surprised if it speeded things up.
Now, what happened when the 3C came along? You were not involved, I guess, once again...
Again, I was not involved in the actual survey. That's right.
But certainly in the analysis... you're a co-author in a paper in Monthly Notices and at the Paris Symposium about comparing 3C with 2C and with MSH and P of D and Morgan, I guess, and so forth.
Are you thinking of Ed Shakecroft and myself?
Right.
That was one of the most gruesome papers I've ever had to write, because I disagreed quite fundamentally with Martin Ryle about what ought to go into that paper. I'm now saying a few of the things that I said I wouldn't say, but... I was inclined to be very much more cautious about what one could assert, largely for the wrong reasons, because what I suspected was that we didn't know what the angular diameters were, and therefore we couldn't be sure that we weren't cutting out a whole lot of bright sources
mm-hmm.
for that reason.
Which were extended. Yeah.
And I knew that the PFD, which I believe more than anybody else did, of course, gave a considerably flatter slope from the source counts taken straight.
And what was Ryle's counterargument that he felt that there weren't many extended sources?
Possibly that. Possibly that. I think he just thought I was being bloody-minded or pedantic or some. Combination of the two. In a sense, I was being pedantic. I didn't believe that on the basis of what little information we had that we knew the answer to the angular diameter problem.
Mm-hmm.
I was no doubt very young and even more tactless than now. We had some jolly good rows. But I must say, the thing which...